You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 2nd of June, 2021. This is being recorded on June 1st. As always, I appreciate everyone who has donated to this, this cause and this channel. I've mentioned before that I'm working on my book on nominalism, which is going to be this, you know, my substantial philosophical work, papers on the decay of discourse in America, medieval metaphysics, and trying to retrain our mind against the postmodern mentality. Russia after Putin. I have so many papers that I'm working on any given time. This is, and to think these are things that kids try to avoid in college. And these are all self-inflicted. So, of course, as always, I solicit donations from my friends to keep this going. Because I'm just getting started here. I don't know if you've noted the Russia Insider review of my book, Ukrainian Nationalism. Because it calls me a national treasure. So, you know, I think maybe you should call me that too. It's going to be my title from now on. So, it's mostly, snippets from my book. But, as this glowing, introduction, Russia Insider is probably the largest English language, website dealing with Russian affairs, and they're completely on the from the nationalist and royalist point of view. So it's absolutely extraordinary. And these things are happening because I get to do this full time with 31 years of experience, and now working on book number 14. You guys were able to finance this. I receive money from no foundation, no university, no church. No rich people. I mean, just simply, it hasn't happened. So anyway, I have another book out that some of you may remember. I did a two-part lecture a couple of years ago on the military dictators of, or so-called dictators of Latin America during the Cold War. And as you know, one of the central missions of this lecture series, this show, has been to rescue people, especially individuals, military dictators, right-wing figures that are largely either forgotten or so badly blackened that you can't even talk about them, or completely unknown entirely, and tell the truth about them. You know, a few examples, the leadership of Uzbekistan many years ago, Kazakhstan, Suharto of Indonesia, Omar Bashir in Sudan, Chung Hee Park of South Korea, of course, the Latin Americans, Ivan Ilin, these people who are either, you know, completely unknown, or forgotten. This is what I do. And I come to the conclusion after all these years that if you take the average educated American, the average college educated American, everything he believes about the world is wrong. He lives in a fantasy world dictated to by major media, entertainment, celebrities, the screen in front of his face. Our job, of course, is to alter the consciousness, at least of a dedicated minority, because history is made only by dedicated minority, to be able to shift how people conceptualize the world. There's almost no point of commonality between the thought of the Middle Ages and the thought of the postmodern West, including the very notion of consciousness itself, the senses. So, today, we're going to do something. I'm going to add to the Latin America book here. I don't deal with Cuba in the Latin America book, which, by the way, Russia Insider helped me publish. It's a Romara Press publication, but the staff of Russia Insider helped me put it together. It has a picture of Pinochet on the cover. And, you know, this here, dealing with Cuba now, and that book, the premise is simple. The story that's told by, you know, the silly conservatives and the establishment liberals, libertarians, all these, you know, ridiculous groups, the story of these people is simply one and the same. These are dictators who are driven by a love of power, who simply dominate for its own sake, mismanage the economy, took over for no good reason, and because they were anti-communist, the U.S. supported them. I mean, to the extent they think about them at all. And that's pretty much the extent of the thinking. You're talking about a history of entire continents here reduced to these slogans. In the Cuban case, you need to keep in mind that the official histories of people like Batista or Castro in the U.S. is identical to the official history of these men in Cuba or the Soviet Union. There isn't a shred of difference between the official Cuban account of Fulgencio Batista on the one hand, Castro on the other, on either side of that non-existent divide. I've said this over and over and over again, that the U.S. never supported anti-communist dictators at any level. They never supported anti-communism. Communism was never the issue. The health of the dollar, the size of the Soviet Union may have been an issue on occasion, but ideology had absolutely nothing to do with it. They did everything they could to overthrow the so-called anti-communist dictators, military leaders, and to install their either liberal or far-leftist opponents. This has happened over and over and over again. But because the myth is repeated so often, and both the artificial sides of the make-believe political debate in America say the exact same thing, it's very difficult to get to the heart of the matter. When I was researching the Latin America book, and the dictators in Bolivia or Peru or Colombia, it was almost impossible to find English language sources. I don't speak Spanish, so I had to use Google Translate, which is not too bad for Spanish. When you get into Russian, Ukrainian, Chinese, it's a disaster, but for Spanish and French, it's not too bad. And at least get the gist of some of the articles here, at least to give me the general background, because there was almost nothing in English, giving even a neutral point of view. In Latin America, making matters worse, the Roman Catholics were on the side, generally speaking, of the leftists. They ran interference. I've talked about Oscar Romero and the make-believe sainthood of some of these communists. So even the church there supports. So where is the defense of these men? And for the most part, they're almost completely forgotten, with the exception of Pinochet. So the level of illiteracy in this extremely important aspect of history, we're talking about an entire continent, keeping these people at the level of the third world, which has been the goal all along. Only the military took places like Taiwan or South Korea out of third world status. I want to add to that book today. I want to talk about Fulgencio Batista. Now, if you remember back in 2016, Fidel Castro died at 90 years old. And I said at the time, the absolute worship of this man exposes exactly what these people want for this country. ABC's Nightline. I'm citing from Investor's Business Daily, which had an excellent article back in 2016 on this. And ABC's Nightline said he is a George Washington of his country. He will be revered for bringing this, you know, social services and everything else to Cubans. And the same thing was said by Andrea Mitchell of MSNBC. Martin Savage of CNN said the same. The New York Times, who supported Castro since 1957, said how he dominated his country with strength and symbolism. Not sure what that means. So there was this this rush. I mean, Barbara Walters was probably the worst. And, well, maybe Oliver Stone. It's hard to tell. And Oliver Stone made a very poor documentary on Castro. But what is the truth of the matter? The truth, of course, is the exact opposite. Now, as they gush and worship Castro, essentially saying they support that system here, they assume, without any functional knowledge, that Batista was a maniacal tyrant controlled by the U.S., the mob ran the casinos, and that was the extent of it. And the U.S. has been trying to overthrow Castro ever since. That Batista was supported. And they never quite define what they mean by support. Anything short of invasion, I guess, is what they mean. And the massive, you know, bipartisan attack on the sanctions that Obama had lifted and then Trump, I think, reinstalled, again, had pure monopoly control. No one really knew, except for some of the exiles, what was going on, not only under Castro, but what happened before him. And the simple answer, of course, is that Cuba would essentially be a South Korea today had Batista and people like him continued to rule the country. The problem is, you know, I've said many times that so many of the massacre stories from these right-wingers are mythical. From Indonesia to South Korea, it's all the same story. The fact that it's all the same story should engender suspicion, but it never does. They're simply repeated over and over again. Any opposition is immediately dismissed. But Marxism has mass cleansing of opponents as a part of the theory. That's essential to Marxism, and certainly Leninism. It's not an anomaly. If you have, let's say, a massacre during a civil war that a non-communist government engages in, it's usually not a matter of policy. It's something that they thought they had to do under the intense pressure of a war. For Marxism, they have this as a part of their theory. The Viet Cong in South Vietnam were not shy about this. They gave awards for wiping out pro-South villages. And of course, the U.S. was well aware of this, as it continued to invest in the Soviet Union that then supplied North Vietnam. The sanctions that, and I've mentioned this before, that Obama put lifted from Cuba were non-existent. I have a whole paper on the nature of sanctions on my Patreon page, and sanctions essentially are stories. Sanctions could only be on very specific companies or individuals doing specific things within a certain time frame. There can't be any blanket sanction on anything. That doesn't exist. You can't tell an American company where to invest. There has to be very specific, and of course the president can make exceptions whenever he wants. By the time Obama lifted those sanctions, they essentially didn't exist. They talk about, you know, Cuban cigars being illegal. That's a way to make people believe that this is. And of course, it was a sugar industry, Archer Daniels Midland, who wanted to support Castro for the sake of investing in the sugarcane fields. And of course, I have the feeling that Hawaiians were upset with this. The Castro regime, like the communists prior to their takeover in most countries, lie about their intentions. In my various books on the Soviet Union and old Russia, the communists, after 1905 and before the revolution, simply made up stories about what they believe. They all claim to believe in multi-party democracy and all this silliness. You know, liberal mush, that was enough to satisfy the British and the Americans. And Castro said the same thing. Now, he was always a Marxist. There's a myth out there that says he was somehow forced into adopting Marxism and going to the Soviet Union because the U.S. was so intransigent in their opposition to him. None of that is even remotely true. The U.S. supported Castro pretty consistently and put a massive weapons ban that it actually enforced on Batista near the end of that very minor civil war. 1958, Fidel said that no mother would ever shed a tear over violence once Batista was gone and he was in power. But of course, once he took over, the opposite was true. The massive Cuban prison system has more prisoners per capita than even in the Soviet era. The murders, the political dissidents are roughly estimated at about 140,000. And that comes from R.J. Rummel, University of Hawaii. And that ended in 1987, I believe. Even Genocide Watch, which is a corporate-financed institution, does say that thousands of people have been murdered, including those fleeing the island. But clearly, the ruling class, through its media, does not agree. But Marxism has the cleansing of opponents as part of the revolutionary process. It's supposed to happen. But Batista was, if nothing else, a very good man. Most of these guys, the military men as he was chief of staff for a while, they take power not because they want to. They're military men. Political power always harms the functionality of an army. It distracts them. There are too many temptations. This is a disciplined institution and a popular one. Batista was from a poor family. Castro was from a wealthy one. He never had to work. He never had a real job in his entire life. But usually, military, I talked about this in the Greek case, all these, you know, the military governments that I've defended over the years, they all have a very similar origin story. They're usually from poverty, usually from rural areas. And the army was not only exciting to them and patriotic, but it gave them a way to advance that very little else in that early society could offer them. And Batista, his political career was generally a very positive one. It's often said that the coup of 1952 was engaged in by Batista because his group was going to lose. He founded several parties. Political parties are largely vehicles for people, not actual parties. That's the case in many places. Was going to lose, and he wanted to forestall that. It isn't true for a lot of reasons. But in fact, it was President Piero that called him in to do this, which Castro had most certainly planned in advance. The whole point of Castro's movement was to attempt to provoke the government into actions that it could then say were terribly brutal. But 2 years later, 1954, he did schedule elections, despite some of the oppositions of boycotting it. He had been president for 2 years at that point. He won a fair election. And because of his nature, he was inaugurated for a four-year term in 1955. He actually believed that he could talk to the communists, and then he released Castro, who, because of his failed military adventures, had wound up in exile in prison, within a general amnesty, which was solicited by, as many have stated, the opposition party, financed from elsewhere. And the idea was that he could restore basic constitutional rule and return to some version of normality, that he could be opposed, but only within constitutional parameters. So the greatest sin he committed was simple naivete. So his government launched what was called the National Program for Economic Development, which encouraged foreign investment, although American investment wasn't very, I think roughly between 6 and 7% of the total, on the promotion of light or consumer industry. He was very interested in boosting employment. And then you had a consumer boom in this era. You had a huge era, because the U.S. was also growing very quickly. You had a huge era of prosperity. Then the government eventually was able to convince the United States to increase, you know, so-called free trade, its quota of sugar from Cuba. And most importantly, the government was a pro-labor, pro-union organization. The problem is, when he opened the floodgates for foreign investment, which he had no choice but to do, non-American money came flowing in. This irritated American capital, and this is why American capital, including the Eisenhower administration itself, ended up backing Castro. Batista, however, being naive, figured that the Program for Economic Development's immense success maybe was able to keep him from having to worry about any kind of opposition. Well, I said the same thing, the massive economic growth in South Korea. How could there possibly have been riots? There isn't a single thing that any opposition party could have done better than Chung Hee Park. The only thing that makes any sense is that these riots were financed from abroad, or specifically communist-inspired, worried that the success of the military as a government, actual government agency, as a government ruler, was going to derail them. My book on Latin American dictators, every one of these leaders, every one of these military men, again, coming from the poor classes, actually did what some of the leftist parties only promised, especially land reform. They were obsessed with this. The oligarchy, locally as well as in the U.S., vehemently opposed military rule. And in my book, I have CIA document, military intelligence document, I mean, one after another, condemning these military government policies. Even worse, wherever you go, anti-communist military rulers, in the actual physical process of handing over land to the landless, were attacked by communists, trying to keep that from happening. In my book on the Soviet Union, I mentioned this too, but the first thing the Soviets did was destroy actual socialist institutions in the country, you know, the commune and the labor brotherhoods and the artels and all that, proving that, you know, workers are not even remotely the concern of communist movements in Cuba and elsewhere. The first thing they did is liquidate actually functioning, although Christian idealist, labor institutions that actually worked for a very long time. So Batista, again, in this you know, conservative naivete, believed that he can create what he called the civic dialogue. That he could bring all of these different groups together under the guise of civility, and especially with a massively exploding economy, and even talk about, you know, slowly releasing power like Pinochet did in favor of some provisional government. And of course, as always, it was the communists that did everything. And not to mention, you know, his predecessors. Intensely corrupt people attempting to destroy these talks for the sake of encouraging the communist movement. There's one author who said that Pirro calculated that by supporting an ensuing anti-Batista revolution, the public would overlook his misdeeds in office. So the only beneficiary, as he says, the collapse of the civic dialogue was Castro. The left functions on... by the way, this is David Paul Bennett, the editor of Social Action Australia, who put this together. It's one of the few very, very good academic papers on Batista and Castro. The mythology is everywhere. As I've said, you know, many times, the left functions on chaos. It's basically Newtonian. It believes in constant motion and chaos to the point where nothing is stable. If nothing is stable, they could then impose their will on a bewildered population. Nothing is stable, you have no functioning institutions. There's no such thing as an individual. There's only various communities that work together. They create a person, not an individual. That has to go. Again, the official history of Castro in America and the official history of Castro in Cuba is exactly the same. One of the funniest aspects of the mythology that, of course, American writers, with a handful of exceptions, support is the so-called guerrilla campaign. And they've painted the most ridiculous, you know, typical leftists. It's all deceit. It's all image. You had this alleged two-year insurgency against Batista before Castro comes to power. The number of combat deaths never exceeded 300. But the New York Times, and we'll see here in a minute with the U.S. Senate and State Department bureaucrats fully admitted that the media State Department combine brought Castro to power. Castro used his interviews with the New York Times, specifically the ignorant Herbert Matthews, to create this myth that this insurgency was this heroic battle against oligarchy. And he was able to take the liberal movement, the 26th of July it was called, and to take this over and turn it into his. But the New York Times, Herbert Matthews, this ignorance, this willingness to believe anything so long as the leftist says it, someone who's going to ban the Catholic Church, of course, which got the New York Times very interested in. This created this story. They created this romanticized vision. Not to mention the fact that most of these groups were from the middle class. The Military Intelligence Service, on the other hand, typical of military intelligence, are drawn from the lower classes. 26th July movement partisans engaged in terrorism as a matter of policy, not as an anomaly. So you had so-called, but the regime only will talk about the excesses of army officers in the 1950s, based, however, on the excesses of the 26th July movement. Whenever you hear about a massacre, whenever you hear about, you know, some alleged, what they call human rights abuses, the question that's never asked is why? And there's a good reason for that. Because the minute you get into the history of why someone would do this, the narrative falls apart. Batista's army, despite the economic growth, was deeply divided. This, again, comes from the U.S. It comes from the media. Frankly, the Sierra Maestra campaign, which he was trying to engage in, flopped because so many of his officers were simply professionally incapable of sustained offensive action. And his officer corps, he did not trust 100%. But he also didn't know how to exploit the divisions on Castro's side. And I think he truly believed, and as did the State Department at the time, that that Castro would just be another liberal politician once he took over, and the rhetoric would fall away. In 1958, Castro called a general strike using the 26th of July movement. And Batista's response was a strong one. And the strike failed. Once that occurred, the 26th of July fell apart, and this is one of the ways that Castro was able to take over. The measures against this were propagandized, even the local, he had no full control over the press, especially the American press, the New York Times, and the State Department. Comments from American policy elites were saying that now Batista is a tyrant. And so then at this point, Batista orders the army to smash Castro. He destroyed the 26th of July movement. Now he can, and he destroyed the general strike. Now he will now finally attack Castro's headquarters, and it failed. But throughout this campaign, Castro made it very clear that he was a liberal, he was a constitutional Democrat, and he would become, this is when he said, you know, no one would ever cry over bloodshed once this is over. You see these governments, you see the, you know, in Latin America, in the White Army, in Russia, the ARVN in South Vietnam, you have similar problems. You didn't have any real grasp of propaganda. Castro and the left, because they're based on deceit, is very good at it. He was engaging in substantial psychological warfare. And, you know, making up stories and saying that the New York Times is on my side, the U.S. State Department, everyone hates this guy, everyone hates Batista, you guys shouldn't be fighting for him. And officers in combat would often back down. You even had contacts. Castro's movement on the one hand and Batista's officers on the other. And he was using disloyal officers to sabotage his military operations. Of course, having, you know, these guys having no idea what he would do once he took over. This is when the Eisenhower administration put an arms embargo against Batista. There was no support for this man. Whatever morale was left in the army was completely destroyed. Batista then finally realized that if he didn't win this, there would be a total Marxist dictatorship over the country. So this is how a man who had a stellar record as president was very popular. Even elements of the left liked him. Pro-labor, massive economic growth, foreign investment, important to the American economy, investing in industry, light industry especially, massively growing incomes, a large army, was able to fall to pieces by a much smaller, much less popular communist insurgency in the countryside where they had absolutely no support. Got to the point, you see this also in the Russian Civil War, where the U.S. was, to say the least, ambivalent about granting Batista any kind of asylum in the U.S. The idea that the previous leader, Piero, could form a junta to attack Castro, of course, was rejected. And it came straight out in 1958. He directly asked the American envoy, William Pauley, if he could move to Daytona Beach. And Pauley states that he, the quote here, from the same article, he says, not officially authorized to offer asylum on behalf of the American government, then quickly denied Batista any exit, which may have forestalled the takeover. Other entities could have taken over, including military entities. So this is how Castro won. And his personal magnetism was absolutely extraordinary. But that magnetism was artificially increased by major media. Major media, as always, create reality. Now, Batista eventually ended up going to Dominican Republic. He tried an invasion in 1959, which failed, which is not the Bay of Pigs. It's a separate thing. And the only reason that it did fail was that there were several double agents. Castro was very good at splitting his enemies. Now, what is the story? I mean, we've been saying this, you know, the story on the economy, which is the central element in politics, especially in our modern era, prior to Castro taking over. The idea, of course, this is a oligarchic third world backwater that Castro brought to modernity and industry, and they say over and over again, this wonderful healthcare system. Now, 1957, the International Labor Organization, which, by the way, is the same group that helped military leaders in Latin America with their land reform scheme, which was thwarted by the communists, stated that the main feature of the Cuban social structure, now this is 57, is a very large middle class. They state clearly Cuban workers are more unionized, proportional to the representation, than U.S. workers. The average wage for an 8-hour day in Cuba in 1957 is higher than for workers in Belgium, Denmark, France, or Germany. Cuban labor received 66.6%. The U.S. 70%, Switzerland 64%, proportionally speaking. 44% are covered by social legislation, various assistance programs, far higher than in the U.S., and this is before the revolution. There's an excellent editorial, an Investor's Business Daily, which I mentioned already, that goes into great detail here. 1958, the GDP per person was but $2,400, the second highest in Latin America. Now, by 2008, that was about $3,700, a growth rate of about 1%. Cuba has the worst, absolute worst economy in all Latin America. But I suppose maybe, you know, someplace like Haiti would be an exception. And that so-called growth is mostly in subsidies, and Soviet bloc investment. Before the revolution, under Batista, Cuba had the 13th lowest infant mortality rate in the world. Lower than France, Belgium, and West Germany. It's now 40th. Today. You know how it was accomplished? Even 40th seems pretty good, except that Cuba has one of the highest abortion rates in the world. There's been a number of Cuban exiles, several writers saying that if there's any trouble, when the baby is born, if there's anything wrong, it is aborted. I'm sorry, obviously, into the later trimesters. I shouldn't say birth. They certainly do have partial birth. But in late trimesters, if there's any problems, it is immediately aborted, regardless of the parent's wishes. This is central Cuban policy, and one of the reasons that it is so vehemently supported by the U.S. That's why they're the 40th highest infant mortality rate in the world under Castro. Because anything wrong with the baby, right up until the moment of birth, it is aborted without parental consent. Of course, as always, you know, the healthcare system is this ridiculous claim the left makes when they have nothing else. Of course, high-ranking officials have their own system. Many come to the U.S., where apparently they're not allowed to go, but they go anyway. And then, of course, the system for everyone else is third world. That was not the case under Batista. Cubans can't even visit elite facilities. They could be in their own city. The hospitals for the average person under Castro doesn't even have the proper doctors and proper certifications to do much of anything. They have to bring their own sheets. They have to bring their own pillows. There's little, dirty mattresses and body fluids that don't get cleaned up. Doctors, for these people, make about $25 to $35 a month. They usually may have to work second jobs, substandard equipment. And remember, the left will scream about American sanctions. They do not cover medical. Never have. In fact, American sanctions didn't cover very much. But there is no sanction law, never was, against medical equipment. Now, you may say that they have, 40,000 doctors working in Latin America and elsewhere. The problem there is that doctors are trained specifically to be sent abroad. They make about $3 billion a year in hard currency from doctors working abroad from foreign states. So it's a deliberate, it's almost an export of theirs. Batista had reached almost universal literacy. The claim was that he did not. That's ridiculous. Universities have absolutely nothing to do with education. They're training for communist bureaucrats. Well, they're like American universities. You have college graduates making roughly, $9, $10 a month. This is absolutely tremendous. The absolute disaster that the so-called Cuban Revolution brought out. The elites have a very different world. That's the world that American academics are shown. Not the world in the inner city and the countryside. The countryside gets very little. Now, it's said, an excellent article by, one of the great, more or less pro-Batista writers out there, Umberto Fontova. He wrote in The American Thinker back in 2009 about the myths and stories that the American regime talks about Fidel Castro. The basic myth, again, Batista's Cuba was a colony of the Americans, exploited by corporations, gangsters, this is the same story. And Castro, of course, rectified this because he's a moral crusader. As I said, by the late 50s, 7%, 6 or 7% of the capital in Cuba was American. Roughly a quarter of the sugar output was done by American companies. He also states that there were 6 casinos in Cuba total at the time. I mean, just one place. Biloxi, Mississippi has 12. Just one town, America. Tourism, including the casinos, made up about $60 million of a $750 million foreign receipts in 57. And that's the product that was $2.7 billion that year. 2 Havana hotels were allegedly mob-owned. So that mythology is nonsense. And my favorite statistics here is that in 1958, the Red Cross estimated that Cuba had maybe 9,000 prostitutes. Today, the estimate is 150,000. Very young. In the 50s, some of you know American pop culture at the time, the Cuban vacation was the dream of your middle-class American. But the other way occurred, too. More Cubans vacationed in the U.S. than Americans did. Cubans didn't come to the U.S. in great numbers to settle. Cuba took in more immigrants, mostly from Western Europe, in the first half of the 20th century than in the U.S. This is one myth after another here. In the healthcare thing, I forgot to mention, Batista maintained several elite hospitals, which he financed. They ran at Mercedes, maternity hospital, all providing free healthcare to the indigent. These provided free healthcare to the urban poor. This was financed specifically as part of Batista's urban program. The only reason that that he could have had opposition is by artificial means. Now, I said before that the U.S. installed Castro in power. That's been one of the central theses of my career, that communism, far from being anything the U.S. regime opposed, in fact, not only supported and created and defended and financed. This has been the case everywhere. The myth of American anti-communism is one of the most absurd, and only a very detailed investigation can expose the absurdity of it. Former U.S. Ambassador to Cuba, Earl T. Smith, 1960 congressional testimony on the issue of the Cuban Revolution, declared, and this is, he just baldly said, we put Castro in power. So I'm not really sure how much clearer you can get here. And he's talking about the CIA, the State Department, the ruling class in general, supporting, of course, the media, supporting the Castro rebel groups. Everything included to put sanctions on Batista. And finally, so much for the support of Batista, the CIA, the American government, ordered Batista to leave the country. And Earl Smith knows a bit about this because he personally delivered the message to him. As I mentioned, also denying him exile in the U.S., just like the royal family in Russia was denied exile in Britain. Now, Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Caribbean desk chief, he is a so-called specialist in the Cuban Revolution, came out and said that, well, his direct quote was, me and my staff were all Fidelistas, supporters of Castro. He says, everyone in the CIA and everyone at state were pro-Castro, except Ambassador Earl Smith. Now that comes not only from Reynolds' group, but also Robert Whitechin, who was a CIA operator fighting Batista in Santiago, Cuba. The U.S. gave recognition to Cuba faster than it gave recognition to Batista's. And the first thing the U.S. did when Castro took over was give $200 million in subsidies for his economic development. 1959, Philip Bonsall, who was the next liberal U.S. ambassador to Cuba, tipped Castro off to conspiracies to overthrow him. Anti-communist Cubans, especially in the countryside, were everywhere. He then turned around and said that the U.S., in its capacity, is a vulture preying on humanity. The anti-Castro plot was foiled, and the plotters in prison were executed. This was a very large number. You had many anti-Castro people, especially early on. So 1958, State Department, CIA, the ruling class in general, despite financing, subsidizing, and defending Castro in every way, still said the destruction of the American government is his true destiny. This could be found in his letters, sending men, often with American money, to overthrow right-wing governments in other Latin American states. Kidnapped 50 U.S. citizens from Guantanamo, jailed, executed several Americans, stole $2 billion from American businessmen at gunpoint. This was going on at the time while being supported and backed by the United States. In the early times of his regime, State Department made, according to Fontova, numerous, he says, over 10 what he calls back-channel diplomatic attempts to figure out why Castro was killing so many Americans, arresting so many Americans. And they use Argentinian President Frondizi, who, of course, was also warning the U.S. about what Castro was. There was never any opposition to him. There was never any attacks on him. But the murders and thefts and everything else led to what can only be considered a deliberately botched Bay of Pigs. Almost immediately thereafter. Bay of Pigs is interesting because the U.S. had actually condemned previous attacks on Castro, the one I mentioned from Batista, in exile in the Dominican Republic. Now, the CIA report on the Bay of Pigs is a failure, which came out in November of 1961, only released in 1998, I believe it was classified for that period of time, laid out 9 specific reasons for its failure, but these reasons are proof that it was a deliberately botched operation. One of the first things is the lack of plausible deniability. There was no attempt to build any support for any guerrilla movement. This was a one-shot deal. The second is that there was no assessment of risks and no ability or desire to communicate information, either among government agencies or even with the rebels themselves. Number 3, they didn't use local leaders. I'm not sure how you can create a guerrilla movement and refuse to talk to local guerrilla leaders, of which there were many. 4, there was no attempt to organize any kind of internal resistance. In fact, the opposite was going on. The American media and the American State Department were supporting and subsidizing him as this is going on. 5, despite the CIA being an intelligence institution, refused to collect any intelligence on the Cuban military and what they were capable of fielding at the time. 6, of course, poor internal management. CIA was apparently suddenly incompetent. 7, they put their lowest-level people in charge of this. The high-quality people were put elsewhere. 8, believe it or not, refusing to use Spanish speakers. Most of these people, CIA people, were not Spanish speakers, believe it or not. And 9, there was no contingency plan. There was really no agenda. This is called the Survey of the Cuban Operation, and that was put together by CIA Inspector General Lyman Kirkpatrick. So I'm not entirely sure if this could be anything other than a way to buttress Castro's government. Can you imagine this level of incompetence? We know the CIA is corrupt. We know that they support the far left. They always have. But you can't go from, as I've already quoted, having the American policy elites supporting Castro, I mean openly supporting Castro. The one ambassador saying the entire State Department was pro-Castro, to suddenly creating an invasion. That doesn't make any sense. You can't do this. It was an attempt to buttress Castro's rule, because the fact of the matter, the Bay of Pigs consolidated Castro's rule. Castro was, like communist governments are early on, very shaky. They don't have strong base of support. They are just revealing what their true agenda is. And the way that the propagandists, both in the U.S. and in Cuba, described everything, suddenly Castro becomes actually popular. He's defending Cuban sovereignty. So somehow an internationalist becomes a nationalist overnight. Now, it isn't the case that suddenly he called himself a Marxist-Leninist at that point. He was calling himself that for a long time. I made that very clear. Of course, the State Department and CIA knew that anyway. But this is allegedly evidence that the U.S. was anti-Castro. But there is no way that those 9 things the CIA itself termed reasons for its failure can be anything but deliberate. And, of course, it was mostly Cubans that were being killed. what the deliberate failure of the Bay of Pigs did for Castro was allow him to position himself as a defender of sovereignty. It made the U.S. look incompetent and absurd. It made Castro look all-powerful. They could take on the U.S. and win. I mean, you didn't even have air support. This doesn't make any sense. This has never happened before. World War II was just a generation earlier. So it's like trying to figure out why the U.S. lost the war against Vietnam when it had just taken 4 years to defeat the far superior Imperial Japanese military. Far superior in every way. It doesn't make any sense with a massive Navy and Air Force. The same thing here. Why would the CIA and the agencies involved refuse to communicate, not even using Spanish speakers? This whole thing was a deliberate attempt to make Castro seem invincible. He was the American man in Cuba. I want to clarify something I said a minute ago. I was talking about in 57, labor under Batista. I said that Cuban labor received 66%. What I'm referring to is gross national income. In other words, of all the money the economy generated in 1957, labor received 66% or 67%. At the time, in the 50s in America, it was 70%, but in Switzerland, it was 64%. At the time, because of strong unionization in both Cuba and in the U.S., you had a substantial amount of money going to labor. This isn't a measure that's used very much anymore. Because, again, in the U.S., that's ridiculous today. But you had 70%, roughly 70% of every penny generated in the Cuban economy going to workers. This is a result not only of Batista's policy, infrastructure, of course, and unionization. He was bringing in foreign direct investment, but only under very specific circumstances. They simply couldn't come in and rake the country. They came in and had to benefit society. You had to use Cuban workers. You had to pay a certain rate. You know, they complain about these, you know, the two mafia-owned hotels, but those jobs were highly prized in the hospitality sector. The best jobs were to be found for your average, you know, say, uneducated Cuban. That's what I meant by that. It's the percentage of the national income. So the point is, Bay of Pigs was simply yet another means whereby the U.S. supported Castro and, of course, dispensed with a large number of Cuban exile. You end up having some of the, and really the one thing is the abortion rate, which the last time I studied Batista's government I kind of forgotten about. I think I kind of just blocked it out. You may understand now why the left saw Cuba as a inspiration. This is the regime that they are installing and have installed in the U.S. It is a one-party state, a tightly controlled media, and political dissidents are thrown in prison. They're not as yet being executed, although there are a few examples of that, like Edgar Steele. But the simple difference between the so-called capital storming, whatever that is, despite the left having done that many times, and the riots of last year is all the evidence you need. They were killing cops. They were killing white people. They were blinding federal marshals. You know, that case in Portland, they're still rioting in Portland. And no one says a word. In fact, police are told to stand down. And entire areas of the cities, including police stations, were ordered, given to the rioters by the city officials. So here you have yet another example of the ridiculous point of view of American academics, court historians, journalists. Depressingly, you have a case where government and media, especially the New York Times, work together to overthrow a very good man military man who did not rule as a dictator. I shouldn't even imply that. He centralized power because of the war that he was involved in. He was, as is the case in so many places, had to deal with military division. This is the case in South Vietnam, too. The possibility of a coup. And the fact that army morale was being sapped throughout that two-year period, deliberately. One of the ways that the U.S. finally defeated Saddam Hussein, certainly not on the battlefield, those casualty rates are largely mythical, but in bribing Iraqi generals with positions abroad to turn on Saddam Hussein. They knew who the weak ones were, who the strong ones were. Something, of course, that any kind of nationalist, you know, right-wing government, especially military government, doesn't seem to be able to do. That's because they're military men. They're not politicians. Political power is not something most people want. Or they may want it, but then once they get it, they realize how miserable it is. This is not why people go into the army. They know that political power, in addition to the responsibilities of being a general or a colonel, are crushing. The men who rise to the top in military are not the same men who rise to the top in leftist politics. They're usually opposites, especially in the third world. The military there had a strong sense of duty and a strong sense of discipline, and mostly came from the lower classes, unlike the left, which usually comes from the upper classes. Everything about the official story, whether it be in Cuba, or the Soviet Union, or the U.S., concerning the Cuban Revolution and Castro is absolutely incorrect. But the very fact that they could use mass compulsory abortion at the slightest problem, right up until the end of the last trimester, and then claim that's the reason why infant mortality is so low, and it's not very low. It's 40th in the world, roughly. It was much higher than that under Batista, with free medical care, which you do not have in Cuba, because the popular hospitals are not medical care. Every single aspect of this, every single aspect of this is a story. The typical fantasy world where everything is concocted based largely on Johnson's Law. When you have all institutions, your conservatives assume that Batista was a terrible guy, like Pinochet was a terrible guy, but there are only a handful of exceptions. The neocons assume this, because they're leftists in general. No one ever asked what these policies were prior to Castro, what any of these policies were, the myths and the stories, because even the church supported the leftists, on and on, especially in Latin America, where liberation theology was born. So, it's one lie after another that's pontificated by university professors and worshipful journalists about a very sick man. Cuba could be, especially, you know, it was mostly a white country at the time in the 50s, could have been another South Korea. A huge a wasted potential. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.